Good afternoon, Your Honors. As is often the case, and is the case here, there is agreement, or at least no dispute, as to a number of important matters pertaining to this appeal. I'd like to pick those off quickly. There is agreement between the parties that this court reviews the lower court's judgment de novo. There is agreement, as Tara's answering brief trumpets, that Mentor has steadfastly, that is the appellant, has steadfastly refused to take a position on the merger. There is no dispute between the parties that Tara bears the burden of proof to show a case or controversy. There is agreement that an actual controversy exists where, in the words of Clemente, quote, one side makes a claim of a present specific right, and the other side makes an equally definite claim to the contrary, close quote. There is agreement that we don't have that situation here. We submit that, in the words of Stevenson, and the case is cited in our opening brief at pages 13 to 17, that, quote, simply stated, it is a general rule that when one person asserts a right and another is silent in regard thereto, there is no controversy, close quote. Now let's turn then to the facts of what occurred here, which are quite simple. There was initially a negotiation between the parties, that is between Tara and its stockholder, its preferred stockholder, Mentor, as to the Series A vote. Mentor had all the Series A stock. And the parties weren't able to reach agreement as to consideration for Mentor agreeing to vote his stock in favor of the issuance of the new preferred stock. There was no dispute at that time, of course, as to Mentor's legal right to vote. During that discussion, there was no discussion of any aspect of a possible merger, or even that a merger was contemplated by Tara. And therefore, of course, there was no discussion of its legality between the parties, and there never has been a discussion as to the legality of the merger between Tara and Mentor. Mentor never threatened litigation at any time in connection with the negotiations over the Series A vote or at any time since that point. Now, the court below seemed to hold that Mentor's refusal to take a position constituted an adverse position. This is not logical or supported by case law. In fact, it removes the essence of the case or controversy doctrine from the equation. No position becomes equal to an adverse position in the lower court's logic. This would, in practical effect, eliminate the case or controversy requirement, which, as this court knows, is a constitutional requirement. In addition, there is no specific allegations of present hardship in the pleadings, or indeed any demonstration of it in the briefs of the appellee, which do go beyond the pleadings. In fact, here, one day after Tara filed and served its original complaint, it consummated the merger, thereby committing the act which it alleged Mentor would claim breached its rights. The most salient purpose of a declaratory judgment is, and here I'm quoting from Rego, quote, to give repose to a party who did not know which way to turn and was therefore removed. In fact, they have the financing that they sought here, and they're using it. Here there is no controversy or hardship. The element of rightness, that there need be no further factual development, which the lower court stressed, is thus really beside the point. We submit that this case was a waste of the lower court's resources and of this court's on appeal. The lower court was, in fact, I would say, lured into deciding in a three-page opinion in one paragraph an issue not even established as being before the court, that is the applicability of the quasi-California corporation law. There was no allegation that it did apply, only in the answer that it might apply depending upon what the facts were. Nevertheless, the lower court went ahead and decided that it would be of no effect. And we suggest that that is a peril of deciding cases where there's no case or controversy, because there was no factual demonstration on that, and there was no briefing on it, and the court just decided it in a way that it thought appropriate, but without benefit of litigating. Unless the court has any questions, I would like really to conclude more or less where I began, namely that this case is, we submit, quite simple. There's never been a dispute between Tara and Mentor on any legal issue, other, of course, than whether this case presents a case or controversy. There was no dispute as to Mentor's rights when Tara sought Mentor's vote before it conceived of the merger. And there was never a dispute about the effect of the merger on Mentor, because the merger was never discussed by the parties. Mentor never made or implied a threat of litigation against the merger. There simply is no case or controversy here, and the court should reverse and send the matter back with instructions to vacate the lower court's two opinions. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Skaggs.
Good morning, Justice Holland. We've just broken into afternoon. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Justice Berger. Good afternoon, Justice Steele. May it please the court, R.J. Skaggs on behalf of the Appellee Tara Systems. The court of chancery ruled that the amended complaint was based on an actual controversy and a ripe dispute. That ruling, which was an exercise of judicial discretion by the court of chancery, should not be disturbed. And that discretionary language is found, although it is somewhat unclear as to a standard of review, because on a 12b6 motion, the general rule says that it is a de novo review, but clearly in the Stroud case and others, this court has said that in finding a ripe dispute, the court undertakes an exercise of discretion, and that discretion exercised by the vice chancellor in this case should not be disturbed. Before looking at the specific facts of what happened here and created the controversy, I would point out three important points that make up the backdrop of the legal setting that we're dealing with here. Number one, the statute and case law require Delaware courts to liberally construe and administer the Declaratory Judgment Act. 10 Delaware Code 6512 says this chapter is declared to be remedial. Its purpose is to settle and to afford relief from uncertainty and insecurity with respect to rights, status, and other legal relations, and is to be liberally construed and administered. That policy is reflected throughout the case law. In many places. And in fact, in the Rollins International v. International Hydronics case, this court held that the term actual controversy should be, and I'm quoting, should be liberally interpreted to give wide scope to the provisions of the Act within the purposes thereof. So when you actually look at whether you're talking about a more general ripeness, discretionary determination with all the factors that come into play, such as all the facts are in place, et cetera, or whether there is the constitutional element of an actual controversy, that the instruction here is to make this as wide as possible. So the Court of Chancery certainly was within its authority and discretion to take on this declaratory judgment action.
Well, let's see how far liberally construe can go. Let's say hypothetically there was a merger where someone had Mentor's rights, you know, before the merger, and then they were extinguished by the merger. But there was absolutely no contact between the parties before or after the merger's consummated. Could you come in and say, we'd like a declaratory judgment from the Court of Chancery that the merger was valid and the rights were properly extinguished?
We think not, Your Honor.
Right. So then what we're really looking at here is, what additional facts do we have beyond my hypothetical?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's right. And there are important facts here, and I'll get to those in just a second. And briefly, once back to my three points that make up the backdrop. The second one is, the case law clearly required the Court of Chancery to exercise its discretion to make a practical and common sense evaluation of the totality of the circumstances. All the circumstances here, whether it generated a controversy that was ripe enough to decide. This is clearly not a formalistic or narrow exercise. An actual controversy does not require one party to say, I have a right to do X, and the other party to say, no, you do not have a right to do X, and in fact, I'll sue you. Law is not that inflexible, and indeed it should not be, because it would be unable to address the kind of posturing to gain an advantage undertaken here by Mentor through its silence after opposing the merger. I'll get to that in more detail in just a second. The third point is that this case falls squarely and undeniably within the type of case that the Delaware law deems important and beneficial to decide by declaratory judgment. Why is that? It's a matter primarily of interpretation, very much like contract interpretation. All the Court of Chancery had to do was look at the certificate of incorporation and decide whether Terra had the right to undertake this merger without a class vote. Also, this is a case where the Delaware court is asked to provide guidance to corporate fiduciaries. As Chancellor Chandler has written more than once, and most pointedly in the Loventhal v. Hilton Hotels case, there's a strong policy in this state of providing guidance to fiduciaries. Indeed, in the Hilton Hotels case, that was a question of whether a poison pill was valid. The company adopted it. A shareholder said, I don't accept it. There was no takeover threat. There was nothing imminent that would have triggered the shareholder rights. But Chancellor Chandler said, it's important in this state. There's absolutely no reason to not give guidance to fiduciaries. So he took that on, even though the facts weren't even all in place that would have triggered these rights in any concrete harm. And lastly, the reason why this falls right within the type of case that the courts in this state should decide is that this is one of those cases where all the facts are in place. And although a mentor would read that out as unimportant, it is clearly something that is important to the analysis, and something found here recognized by the Vice Chancellor. He was able to make that summary judgment decision based on a reading of the certificate of incorporation. So to address your question, Justice Holland, with respect to what is it here that creates the controversy, and you have to look at all the circumstances. What is it? First, we start with a pre-existing relationship with the parties, and Vice Chancellor Lamb referred to that in his ruling. These parties are not strangers. They're in the same business enterprise. Their rights and relationship are important to the success of this company, as we found out, as Terra found out when it tried to do a financing. Second, Minter opposed the financing transaction between Terra and Sequoia. Minter has never withdrawn that opposition.
Opposed it by asking for compensation, or where in the record would we read the document that says we oppose it?
It's undisputed that Terra went to Minter and said, we want to do this financing. Here's your right. Will you vote in favor of this financing? And they not only said, no, we won't. They said, pay me and I will. They didn't say, we think this is a bad business judgment for the company. They were on the take. And that creates the inference going forward, as the Vice Chancellor found, that they continue to be on the take, particularly where after the issue was squared up for them, they never provide any explanation for why they refused to speak. They will not take a position on the merger, and the only reasonable inference is because they want the cloud to continue over this financing to gain an advantage over Terra, to keep pressure on Terra. So this was a merger, so then Terra does execute the merger. Now, this merger is not unrelated to this financing. It's very integral to it. In fact, it is a step taken specifically to overcome the opposition of Mentor. In other words, this merger, which Mentor would have you believe is completely unrelated with financing, would never have happened nor been necessary but for the opposition of Mentor. These things are inherently intertwined and linked. So now we have the merger and the link between them. Mentor has steadfastly refused to disclose its position, and this is important. In fact, the O'Hagan's case, cited by Mentor in this case, indeed recognizes that a refusal to speak in the right circumstance, a refusal to waive rights once you've created a controversy, is a factor the court may consider. Now, in that case, the court said, we don't think it speaks volumes here, because in that circumstance, it would have required a full evaluation of patents and sort of a whole technical evaluation that wouldn't necessarily, would be a real drain on resources and may not be something that they wanted to undertake.
Well, let's make sure the court's following you so far. As I understand your first point, it was a request to Mentor to agree to the original financing, which I guess you needed because of the way their stock was written, and they wouldn't do that. Then your client came up with an alternative for going forward with the financing without Mentor's agreement, according to your reading of the law. So you went forward with the merger. And let's assume that the record is clear that the Mentor objected or wouldn't consent to the financing before the merger idea came up. Since the issue on this appeal is the validity of the merger, what record support do we have for Mentor in any way contesting, challenging, questioning the merger?
And it, you do have to look. Can I cite you a letter, a phone call, anything where Mentor said, we don't believe the merger is valid? No, I cannot. But the point of the case law is you have to look at the overall circumstances here, and that's what's so important about the conduct here and the way Mentor has conducted itself both before and after the merger, which is we will not approve it unless you pay us, followed by we will not say a word, when, in fact, they could have saved, as pointed out by the Vice Chancellor, substantial resources by any time.
Well, Mr. Richards cites cases for the general proposition that if you're asked to take a position and your response is no comment, that that doesn't create a controversy. How would you distinguish those cases?
Sure. And it would be on the prior dealings of the parties in the overall business setting. For example, we cite the Dewey and Almay Chemical, the American Anode. In that case, there was no conversation whatsoever between the parties. There, the declaratory judgment defendant had sued people on patents, other parties on patents, that could have arguably read upon processes used by the declaratory judgment plaintiff and had made it known they would enforce. But there was no communications at all between those parties. And still, there was a controversy found. In addition, the Pembroke case, where there was prior dealings, in that case, the two parties had set up a company. The declaratory judgment plaintiff had indicated to the declaratory judgment defendant that it no longer had rights in that company. And the defendant did not contest that. Then filed for a declaratory judgment, and the defendant stayed mute, remained silent because he didn't want to get involved. It was afraid of getting sued or whatever. And the court found a controversy because that controversy was created by the earlier dealings combined with the refusal to take a position, which, as I said, even the O'Hagan's case, even the cases cited by Mentor, acknowledge is a relevant factor when you look at all of the circumstances. So it's not as easy as saying, and it would be a mistake as far as law and policy for this court to say there has to be something as clear-cut as saying, do you oppose this merger? Yes or no? Yes, we do. Okay, now I have jurisdiction. When what that leaves open is exactly what's happened here, is the ability for one party, through its silence, after creating a controversy, after opposing something while it was seeking in a self-serving way to obtain advantage and profit, to remain silent in a setting where that then injures the party who can't get declaratory relief, if you were to rule this case.
Can we focus on that for a moment?
Sure.
You talk about the cloud that's hanging over Terra. What exactly is this cloud?
Okay. They attempted to go out and get financing
right.
for this merger. They had a difficult time doing it, number one, but they did get financing, no doubt. That financing is contingent upon this merger not being successfully challenged. If it is, and this merger is declared invalid, Terra must immediately repay with interest all the investment that it's received from Sequoia. Now, that, once again, case law says take a practical common sense view. That hamstrings a board of directors or management. How are they going to go out and execute a robust business plan while looking over their shoulder thinking, where am I going to come up with the money to pay this back if Mentor, who is hovering, jumps in? This is all against the setting where Mentor at any time could have written a letter, filed an answer, and said, fine, our Delaware's lawyers have looked at this. They can read the benchmark case. We don't oppose this, or we do. But they won't do it, and they won't do it because they want that cloud to continue. If they want to keep pressure on Terra and eventually obtain a payoff or leave this state this and go to California and sue on the quasi-California theory that we've heard was in the answer, that's all to obtain an advantage. And that's why this court should not disturb the discretion exercised by the vice chancellor when he looked at the overall circumstances and said, this is something I should decide. So it would be our submission that the, in light of all those circumstances, that the only reasonable conclusion, and certainly the conclusion reached by the Court of Chancery that shouldn't be disturbed here, is that Mentor is intentionally withholding its position on the merger to gain an advantage.
Can I interrupt you for a sec? Let's change the facts just slightly and have a situation where your company has gone through any kind of a transaction, let's make it a merger as it was here, and secures financing, and the financing has a clause in it that says that this financing is contingent upon there being no adverse ruling in a court of competent jurisdiction as to the validity of whatever, whether it's the merger or your corporate standing or, you know, any of a variety of things that could be on their mind. That certainly doesn't give you a case or controversy to come in and say, well, Your Honor, you know, we've got this contingency in our financing and it makes us really nervous, so please, you know, put this to bed.
Oh, I agree, Your Honor. And the difference here, of course, is there was a very identifiable party who had expressed opposition to this financing, and that was Mentor. And I believe our complaint states or fairly infers that that condition was put into the financing specifically because of Mentor's opposition. So COYA was very worried about Mentor hovering to come in and attack this merger, invalidated stock, so it insisted on protection.
Well, let's suppose there was a catastrophic accident involving your client and one other party, and it was clear to your client that they were not at fault, but you're trying to get financing and the statute of limitations hasn't run, and the lender is saying, we'd like some assurance that you're not going to be at fault for this catastrophic injury. We're going to probably be thinking about having a contingent liability on your financial statement or something. We don't want one. If you went to the other party and said, we'd like you to agree this wasn't our fault, and the other party said, well, the statute of limitations doesn't run for 2 years, and was basically non-committal, could you go in and get a declaratory judgment that your client wasn't at fault?
Your Honor, I don't believe, and I can't answer that completely, but I don't think that is our situation, and I don't know why we would be able to in that instance, because once again, the key is the prior business relationship between the parties and the opposition of Mentor. In the accident example, say there was a wreck in a milk truck, and before I had been dealing, it was the person who supplied me the milk trucks, and we've been talking about some defect in the milk truck, and the other party had said, don't drive those milk trucks, we're doing a recall, and we drove them anyway. Well, could it be driver negligence, something else? Well, in that case, you know, depending on the other all circumstances, probably so, because there had been previous dealings in a situation that made it fair and equitable, as well as, you know, at least a constitutionally minimal controversy, to have a declaration of the party's rights. Now, that's a little bit different because it's a tort action and not a contract action here, where you can just look at the papers and not use many judicial resources. So I think that's the way I would answer that. There are the other five factors. I don't think there's a lot of dispute about those. The need to conserve resources, once again, there was no discovery required here. Due respect for identifiable policies of the law, I talked about that. This is where we're giving guidance to fiduciaries of a Delaware corporation. Certainly that's something this court should recognize, a policy that's an important thing for Delaware courts to do. The Court of Chancery did find, based on the pleadings and other things it could refer to in making a jurisdictional determination, that there was injury going forward for lack of declaratory judgment. This is, in effect, a very sophisticated party, Minter, and they have undertaken, by silence, a type of posturing that amounts to a gamesmanship, both with Tara and with the Court of Chancery. They essentially played coy, and that's what the Vice Chancellor told them. That's not something that the Vice Chancellor was prepared to tolerate, and we submit that this Court should not either, and ask you to affirm the Court Chancellor's decision.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to address briefly some of the points made by my opponent. I guess I would like to start off by saying that it seems to me that this is the paradigmatic situation in which Tara should have and probably did rely on the opinion of its own counsel in going forward. Quoting from Stevenson, I think another quote that's applicable, the fact that the plaintiff's desires are thwarted by its own doubts or by the fears of others does not confer a cause of action. And I suggest that that's what we have here. Now, in response to one of the points my opponent made, he asserted that we opposed the financing. Actually, we didn't oppose the financing. What we tried to get was consideration for a favorable vote by our Series A stock because the financing was the issuance of stock which would be superior in rights to our Series A stock. And so we thought we were entitled to some consideration, but we weren't opposed to the financing as such. He says we've never withdrawn our opposition to the financing. Well, the financing is a fait accompli. I mean, there's no situation or circumstance under which we would have been obliged to say, well, now, you know, we're not any longer opposed to the financing. I mean, that was really not the issue. He mentions the Dewey case as being applicable. I just can't resist bringing to the court's attention that in the Dewey case, the defendant was the owner of a patent and was suing to prevent infringement of its patent. And at the trial of that case, the head of the plaintiff's patent department, a man named Brown, was attending, and he sat next to the president of the defendant, Mr. Albright. And Albright told Brown, in effect, that it was a disappointment to him, and I'm quoting, that the manufacturers did not recognize the great contribution which Anode had made to the rubber dipping art, and now that the manufacturers were ganging up on them, they had to put a stop to it. And that's a very different situation. I mean, there was in the trial of where he was suing one of these infringers, and he was telling the other guy, we're going to put a stop to this. And I suggest that that case really supports our point of view as opposed to my opponents. He refers to the fact that there is a contingency in the financing, but that is just something that they say in their brief. There's no... The terms of the financing or any allegations about it are not in the complaint. And it's not clear from what they say in the brief whether that is actually a contingency in the financing agreement itself or in a normal circumstance that it would exist. Of course, if the merger is invalid, then the preferred stock issue to Sequoia by reason of the merger would not be valid. And it's not really clear to me, and it's not clear at all on the record, whether that's a contingency imposed by Sequoia or whether that's just a circumstance of what the result would be. Similarly, there's no statement in terms of the hardship. There's no statement that there's any impairment on the use of the financing which they've now secured. They simply have said that, well, if this merger was declared invalid and if we had to pay the money back, that would be an awkward circumstance. I think that this case stands for the proposition that would be of interest to many defendants in a similar situation, that my client feels that it has a right not to be sued and to have to incur the expenses of counsel in order to resolve the doubts and fears of Tara. And I think that many of the hypotheticals that your honors have thrown out here are similar to or a little bit removed from. But I think that the principle that's at stake here is an important principle, at least to my client, and I think for our courts.
Thank you.
unless your honors have a question, that concludes my argument.
I do have one question, Mr. Richards. this concern for Delaware being amenable to giving guidance to fiduciaries is what's on my mind. If Mentor expressed in any way concern about the financing because it might adversely affect their equity position or their financial position in the company, and Tara had made the business judgment that they needed for the benefit of the company to go forward with the financing, wouldn't they also be concerned about doing right to Mentor and want to get some guidance from the court about whether going forward with the financing under these circumstances might be a breach of their fiduciary duty, if any, to Mentor? So is it not a classic situation where we provide a service to Delaware corporations to come to the court and ask that question so they're not caught betwixt and between what they think is yep. the best interest of the company but a possible breach of fiduciary duty to someone for whom they must act in trust, so to speak?
No, I think not, Your Honor. As Your Honor put it, Your Honor, as you put it, has really taken the case or controversy out, and you raised an interesting policy question, namely, would Delaware be providing a beneficial service if companies or people on behalf of a company could come in and say, look, we're doing this, we're doing that, you know, are we doing the right thing? I'm sure there'd be lots of people who would want to take advantage of that service. But
well, but is it not a case in controversy when they ask the person to whom they act as a fiduciary, this is what we'd like to do in the best interest of all of the people for whom we act as a fiduciary? And the response is, but before you do that, because it's not in my interest, I'd like you to address the way in which it adversely affects my financial interest.
Right.
I won't put it quite as bluntly as your opponent did and
right.
say, pay me,
right.
and then I'll go along with it. But wouldn't that be a circumstance where the fiduciary would want the air cleared so they'd know whether or not there would be a controversy and how to resolve it fairly to all sides, and then come to the Delaware court for the answer to that question?
Well, obviously they want that because they, you know, they have come here. The question really is whether they are entitled to it and whether or not there is a sensible rule, and I think it's of constitutional proportions, really protecting the court against anybody coming in for an advisory opinion simply where somebody would like to know, would like to be absolutely sure. I mean, sure, you can get the opinion of counsel, but we all know that counsel are sometimes wrong. I mean, in thinking back to what I've spent so much of my time on, and not in the last couple of years, but over 15 years on these takeover cases, there were many, many times when you would like to have known whether this defense or that defense was going to work, and you weren't able to go in there. And many of those cases were resolved because somebody would sue you and attack the defense that you were using. But there were other circumstances in which people did go in and say, well, we would like some advice about this, and the court said, well, no, that's just a business judgment that you're going to have to make, and there is no case or controversy, and you'll have to go forward, you know, with your tender offer or forward and see whether you get the merger, and then we'll address the
question. And this court saw that in McMillan, where we had the McMillan case under advisement, and it turned from a defensive posture to a sale, and all the attorneys wanted us to comment on the defense. But putting that aside, as I understand the facts in this case, your client initially was asked to subordinate their position to new financing. And they said, if we're going to be taking a junior position, we want to be compensated. And they weren't.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct.
And then they decided to do it a different way, where they didn't have to worry about your agreement to subordinate, because if they were correct, they could just merge and go forward.
Correct. And there never has been a word of discussion about that, about the merger or its validity.
Mr. Richards, would your client be stopped at this point from bringing suit, let's say, in California or anywhere else, to contest the validity of the merger?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe we would be. I mean, our position, I think the Justice Holland put it very well, that really our position amounted to no comment.
So we're, if we were stopped, I mean, that's what the Vice Chancellor Lamb was trying to put us to, which I think is a distortion of the case or controversy doctrine. He said to Mr. Raju, well, you're going to have to say what you're going to do. And I think the law is that you don't have to. You can say, no comment, I haven't taken any position. And so obviously, if in response to Your Honor's question, I were to say my client was stopped, it would be the same thing as answering Vice Chancellor Lamb's question.
Thank you both.
Thank
very
you.
Much. The court will take the matter under advisement and stand in recess.
Please rise.